Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. The martinis are not, I repeat, not apocalyptic today, so we're headed in the right direction. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, we begin with good news, which is related to the ongoing stumbles of the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign. This is from Politico. With 5 days to go until the Nevada caucuses, once viewed as Hillary Clinton's Western firewall, Senator Harry Reid and his allies are incensed at the wounded Democratic frontrunner. The reason? The Clinton campaign's attempt to downgrade expectations there by whitewashing the diverse state. The campaign's recent assertion that Nevada is, quote, still a state that is 80% white voters, unquote, in other words, a state that looks a lot like Bernie Sanders' base, is simply wrong, Reid allies claim. But more galling than that, they say it undermines the entire rationale for the caucus's existence. The state was pushed to the front of the election calendar 8 years ago solely because Reid lobbied for better demographic representation than the overwhelmingly white early voting states like Iowa and New Hampshire. So, Jim, she's not only underperformed, but she's ruined a narrative, and that cannot be forgiven.
It's kind of fun to watch Reid and, you know, Clinton camps go after each other. But I think what the more fascinating thing is, like, think about how the thinking within the Hillary Clinton campaign, that one, they feel the need to put out these pre-spin arguments, this excuse for why they may not do as well in Nevada as they hoped. Obviously, they're seeing something that makes them unnerved. The second thing is that think about what's at the core of this argument here, Greg. Well, look, you can't expect Hillary Clinton to do well amongst white voters. Okay, I can't, you know, she certainly seemed to do okay with them in 2008, and didn't she do, you know, the Democratic primary, and she seemed to do okay in New York in 2006 and New York in 2000. Why would she be bad amongst white voters, right? I mean, yes, you know, minority voters have always been a key component of the Democratic coalition. Yes, Republicans traditionally have done better amongst white voters, but like, if you're terrible amongst white voters, you're going to have a problem in a national election. This is still a country that has plenty of white voters. So the entire explanation from the Hillary team doesn't make much sense. And it reveals more weakness than they intend. And just they can't even lower expectations without alienating allies and creating a mess for themselves. So this is Hillary's campaign really is not deft in its political touch. And we can only expect more of the same, and it's probably going to go for more grief until before this campaign is over.
All right, on to the bad martini now, and this is kind of a delicious bad martini, if such a thing exists. But yesterday in the Morning Jolt, Jim found a link to a speech by New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer in July of 2007, not in February of an election year, July the year before, once Democrats had taken control of the Senate following the 2006 midterms, as to why Democrats should basically resist an attempt to confirm any more potential Bush nominees to the Supreme Court. Here's what Schumer said at the time.
We should not confirm any Bush nominee to the Supreme Court except in extraordinary circumstances. They must prove by actions, not words, that they are in the mainstream, rather than we have to prove that they are not. So in conclusion, in the end, these three questions provide the foundation for thinking about how we ensure that our court reflects what America wants, rather than what a diminishing clique of conservative ideologues wish for.
And then he went on in that conclusion to rip that harsh right-wing ideologue John Roberts, because he's been such a...
John Roberts could someday destroy national health care.
So, of course, the Republicans are gleefully pointing to that quote from Chuck Schumer, and now Schumer's out with a statement saying, no, this is a completely different situation. He says the comparison is an apples-to-oranges comparison to the current vacancy because he would have at least entertained the nomination and voted on it. This is according to Susan Ferriccio at the Washington Examiner. From Schumer, quote, Senator McConnell's attempt to justify his unprecedented obstruction with my speech is completely misleading and patently false, he wrote on the website Medium. So, Jim, it's not fun having the shoe on the other foot there.
Greg, let me be simple and straightforward. It's apples and oranges because I said that when it was a Republican president, and now we have a Democratic president. Does that straighten it out for you? The reason we say this is the bad martini, even though it's almost funny in the total reversal of his position, ultimately, this shows the philosophy of Democrats. They're going to say, oh, no, we're totally different. It's totally different now. Now, if the argument is, all right, Republicans, you should not reject any conceivable Obama nominee without examining them. Suppose tomorrow Obama were to nominate conservative judge Miguel Estrada. Well, sure. Okay. Well, we'll give him a hearing. Then we'll vote him on there. It'd be great. Obama's not going to do something like that. So there's an argument to be made that Senate Republicans should not reject any potential nominee out of hand. Schumer is saying, well, back then I was open to seeing who the nominees were, which really wasn't the vibe you got from those comments at all. But at least he'd give them a hearing and at least he'd see that they get a vote, even if he was going to vote against any potential Bush nominee. Okay, fine. I suppose if you want to have the Republicans in the Senate, you know, enact that same standard now, fine. Every Obama nominee will get a hearing. Every Obama nominee will get a vote. 99.99999% of the time, that vote's going to give you a rejection. And if that's the way they want it, fine, we can go through with that. This does give an incentive to Obama to pick the most moderate or the pick who it'd be the hardest no for Republicans as possible, as opposed to an easy no like Eric Holder or Attorney General Lynch or somebody like that. You know, the more extreme to the left it is, the easier it is for a Republican to vote no. If he picked somebody who was in the middle, you might get some Republicans, particularly those who are in tough reelection races in 2016, to waver a little bit.
Jim, I distinctly remember this. I'm sure you do, too, that Sandra Day O'Connor announced her retirement at the end or in the summer of 2005. And that's who John Roberts was originally nominated to replace. Mm-hmm. Then Chief Justice Rehnquist died and Bush said, well, we want to get this term started on time, so I'm going to nominate Roberts for Chief Justice, and O'Connor can stay on the court until I find a replacement for her, which turned out to be Sam Alito. And I distinctly remember Chuck Schumer going to the Senate press room there and saying it was incumbent upon the president for the good of the balance of the court to make sure that it was a moderate, someone just like Sandra Day O'Connor, so yep. There wasn't a major yep. ideological swing. Not hearing that this time.
Yeah, and by the way, there's you could make either of these arguments, right? You could make the argument that, you know what, it's not good to have all of one political philosophy represented on the court with an overwhelming majority. Because Supreme Court justices are not ever reelected, because they're lifetime appointments, they are less accountable to the people than the other branches of government, that you would want a court to be relatively ideologically balanced so that all views are represented. Or you can say, look, this is the way judicial nominations and fights have always been. And in fact, most, you know, both sides of the aisle have appreciated when the court has ruled in their favor. You could say that, look, there was not a consensus for abortion rights when Roe versus Wade came down, but it did, and that ended up having an impact, an enormous impact, and for many of us, it's a perspective of a bad impact on American life for a generation. You could do the campaign finance decision, which, you know, for most folks on the right, basically concurred with this perspective that money is speech. You cannot limit speech right before an election. Efforts to suppress someone for making a movie critical of Hillary is basically a tantamount to the government attempting to restrict political speech, and we shouldn't do that. The court helped clarify that and move things in that direction that way. Presidents get the right to nominate their justices, and the Senate has the right to either accept them or reject them. If you have, you keep seeing, you know, folks like Elizabeth Warren insisting, look, the American people have already had a say on Election Day 2012. It's interesting that she doesn't think the people made the same decision on Election Day 2014, huh, Greg?
Good point. Good point. Another thing that baffles me, and I thought Cruz could have done a much better job on this in the debate when he got into that little back and forth about exactly when Anthony Kennedy was confirmed. Yeah, maybe he was confirmed in very early 1988, but do Democrats really want to get into why that confirmation happened when it did? It's because they launched a smear tactic campaign against Robert Bork in the summer of 1987 and got him defeated. Then they got all bent out of shape about a judge who had smoked pot decades earlier and rubbed him out. And then Anthony Kennedy was the third choice, yet 4 years later, the Democrats were nominating a pot smoker for president of the United States. So there's a reason why the timing of that was what it was.
My only thing I will add to this, Greg, is that having this argument on Twitter yesterday, somebody said to me, oh, so you're still mad about something that happened 30 years ago. Well, the entire way the world of judicial fights came out of the Bork decision, right? That basically up until then, you can look back, Scalia, you know, even Ginsburg, these people get 90 members of the Senate, 98 nothing, right? It was a broad bipartisan consensus that as long as there was nothing unethical about the judge, as long as they are qualified, the president gets to pick his own judges. And then along came Bork, and Ted Kennedy rushed to the Senate floor and said that he was going to resegregate America. and it was going to basically take America back to the dark ages. And ever from since that, it became okay to say, well, even though this guy is totally qualified, even though he'd probably make a perfectly fine justice, I don't like his ideology. I don't like his legal philosophy. I don't like the decisions he's made. So I'm voting against him. And we've been living in that world ever since. And all of a sudden, you know, now the Democrats want to say, oh, you can't do that. You can't do that. You can't, you know, vote for somebody just because you don't like their philosophies. Wait a minute. What have they been doing for all of these, you know, it's like they want to erase 30 years of history.
On to the crazy martini now, Jim. And obviously, this year's Democratic race has taken on an interesting twist because Hillary Clinton was thought to have an easy path to the nomination. But lo and behold, there's a guy from the Northeast who hates Wall Street, who is finding a lot of support from the grassroots and young people, and who are ready to take on the 1% because of all this unfairness out there. Had a certain event not happened, I believe it was in 2009, it probably wouldn't be Bernie Sanders out there making that case. It would be successful, and I use that term in quotes, two-term New York Governor Eliot Spitzer. But a funny thing happened on the way to that two-term governorship. He got exposed as client number 9 at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington. And as we've learned in recent days, while Spitzer is now out of office, out of a job at CNN, out of his marriage, some habits die hard. Here's the CNN report about allegations from a $5,000 a night Russian prostitute that Spitzer choked her.
On Saturday, there was a call placed from the Plaza Hotel saying there was an emotionally disturbed person in a room. Law enforcement went there. They found the alleged victim with what they are saying were self-inflicted cuts on her wrists. She was transported to the hospital. Once at the hospital, she said Eliot Spitzer, her boyfriend, had tried to choke her. Now, law enforcement sources are telling us that Spitzer went to the hospital with a skull cap on to try to hide his identity, referring to himself as George. And the investigation continues at this point. Spitzer's camp is denying that anything remotely happened like this, but he does admit that he knew her.
But said later that she was not his girlfriend. So, Jim, obviously George not quite as creative as Carlos Danger, but we're very fortunate that this guy never came close to the White House.
Yeah, one of the things that I was marveling about as this news came over yesterday is, you know, there are probably worse human beings in elected office in American history, although you got to look hard. But the amazing thing is that, so he has this awful prostitute scandal. One of the prostitutes describes him getting violent in the past. So the idea of Eliot Spitzer getting involved with a young woman doesn't seem like it's completely unthinkable. But right after that, man, CNN hired him and gave Adam co-anchor the 8 p.m. hour and then solo anchor the 8 p.m. hour. And when that was a ratings disaster, Current TV picked him up and then he ran for comptroller and he nearly won the Democratic primary. Everybody was really eager to forgive this guy. Everybody was really eager to say, he's not that bad. Well, no, maybe he's really horrible. Maybe he's a really horrible human being that makes you start saying, maybe Anthony Weiner isn't so bad. I hope that this is the end of Eliot Spitzer in public life. I hope he manages to stay away from public office and from high-profile media gigs, and we stop trying to avert our eyes from utterly abominable behavior, alleged abominable behavior, as described in this New York Post report.
The woman has gone back to Russia, so this case may not end up having any legs, and the allegation simply may not be true. Jim, it's back to a fairly bizarre third martini away from the conspiracy.
We've gone from terrible to bizarre. Don't you feel better, America?
Yeah, it's only Tuesday. By the end of the week, I'm sure everything will be hunky-dory. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Wednesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.